Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Writing the Rapids, the show where I, Joe Bilecki, talk to writers about writing. Very often, those writers have been recommended to me by writers who have previously been on the show. In the case of this month's guest, Ben Nespajani, he was recommended to me by Laura Paul. If you like this episode, go back and listen to that one, and if you liked that one, make sure you stick around. Ben is a Chicago-based writer, educator, curator, and folklorist, the author of two books. His writing has appeared in Indiana Review, Booth, Bennington Review, Conduit, Fence, and elsewhere. Along with hosting the Neon Knight Mike reading series at The Whistler, he recently launched Pajama Press, with its first release, a book of poetry by Keek Araki Kawaguchi, out now. You can find more at neonpajamas.com. Before we get into my conversation with Ben, I'll remind you, you can help out the show in a couple of different ways. Patreon.com/NoisemakerJoe. For just $2 a month, you can get these podcasts a little bit earlier than everybody else. You can toss me a one-time donation over at paypal.me/NoisemakerJoe, or you can buy my book. It's called Tired, and it's very good. Without spending any money, you can signal boost, repost, reshare, re-comment. I say that because I want you to do those things multiple times. Tell a friend, and then retell a friend to make sure they've actually listened to it. All of those things are greatly appreciated. Now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Ben. Last month, I think it was. It kind of feels like every episode I did is I just did last month. It's weird when I'm like, I feel like I just talked to this person, and it was like 2 years ago. Last month, I'm willing to put money on it, I talked to Joe Koch, and I talked to him about how the word surrealism, the term surrealism and the word surreal to describe somebody's writing felt more true to my definition of it when reading his writing than most of the time when surreal is bandied about. It feels often like surreal is a more fancy way of saying weird without, and therefore you sort of lose the like historical context of what surrealism in art means and looks and feels like and the process. And in No Farther Than the End of the Street and Cardboard Clouds, also felt surreal in that like correct historical sort of way. Not in the way that Joe's writing is, because his is obviously horror and yours is more lighthearted. And I saw at the end of No Farther Than the End of the Street, you mentioned Leonora Carrington. And I'd be damned to find other painters to associate with, because my interest in surrealist painters, insofar as I have one, is largely the darker ones. But like even his last name is Kush. Vladimir Kush has very sort of whimsical, surreal paintings where these things like melt into each other, and lots of nature in it too. So I was thinking a lot about like, oh, this is the other kind of surrealism that I'm aware of, as is this, you know, not cartoony, but good dreams, better dreams than the paranoid nightmares of Dolly or whatever.
Yeah, I almost feel like, yeah, when you say cartoony, I think that's closer to what I kind of grew up on and where the inspiration comes from. When I think of like influences and writing into surrealism, I definitely wasn't learning from like the canon and the greats. I think I was watching Ren and Stimpy and The Mask and Animaniacs. And I think those early, you know, Cartoon Saturdays largely influenced what I do now. And I think I'm much more interested in, you know, somebody waking up in the morning and they sprout a third arm or their head falls off and rolls down the stairs, than something more like the Dadaist movement, which I feel like is just like throwing words onto a page and having it be very like whimsical and wild and not really making much sense. Whereas I feel like my stuff is a slight tinge of surrealism introducing it or it added into like what my normal day life might be. So someone's going on a normal walk, and then, you know, they see a snake and the snake starts talking to them, as opposed to like, using a really absurdist restraint or constraint. And I think of even like the like Olympian writers who wrote whole books without the letter E, for example. And I feel like a lot of these like absurdist, surrealist, Dadaist is kind of all lumped together when I think about my history, but I'm not that educated in that world. And even like Leonora Carrington, I love her paintings, but she has a book of short stories out with Dorothy Project. And that was my introduction to her. And then from there, I found out about her paintings. But she has a short story where there is like a royal daughter and she doesn't want to go to this ball. So she befriends a hyena. And the hyena is like, well, if you don't want to go, I'll go in your place. Let me just rip off your face. I'll put it over my face and no one will know. And they do that. They hatch that plan. And the hyena goes to this ball with her face. And no one thinks anything differently other than the hyena smells terrible. And that's the factor. It's not the face or the fur, but it's the smell. And she has another one where she falls in love with a wild boar and they have a bunch of kids. So those just like really weird, kind of grotesque, surreal. I think it's kind of similar to what Jim Carrey was doing in the 90s or what Ren and Stimpy are doing, you know, where it's like your parents are kind of like, I don't know if this is appropriate, but it's weird. So turn it off. You know, one of those kind of those situations. And I think my writing has always gone in that direction where I'm kind of, you know, surrounded by reality during the day. So when I go to write, I want to be surprised. I want to be shocked. I want to have some strange weirdness going on. I don't think I could ever do like a memoir or autobiographical writing because I just live that today. I want to write about something strange that, you know, takes me by surprise or throws a curveball. And, you know, I don't know where the next sentence is going to take me.
Dude, that's so sick. That must be so nice. That must be so great. I say that like very genuinely, like that must be great. That must be so cool.
Yeah, just embrace the strange. That's kind of my motive. The weirder, the better is another one.
Yeah. Yeah. The very early days of this podcast, there was a lot of me trying to grapple with what people meant with the term bizarro. And I think I finally kind of got it with Rick Claypool's Skull Slime Witch Tentacle War. I said it wrong. That one, that just came out. That sort of like, again, Ren and Stimpy, if they didn't have to or weren't trying to make it for kids sort of thing.
Right.
But yeah, most of Nickelodeon for me growing up was either explicitly told to me by my parents that I could not watch it or felt like something I shouldn't be watching. And so I prevented myself from watching it. Rugrats and I don't know, just so much of that time on that channel particularly was like, it was like MTV for kids, kind of, almost.
Even like Rocco's Modern Life is like, some of those I tried rewatching them recently and some of the clips are just very strange. And yeah, the fact that that was being fed to 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds is so fascinating. Yeah, Ren and Stimpy was the only one that my parents were like, you can't really watch that. We think it's too weird. But all the other ones were fair game. And I think, you know, I think Rocko's Modern Life was equally as strange. I think Animaniacs was equally as bonkers. Yeah, even some of the sketches from like All That, you know, which is basically like SNL for kids, like they were so surreal and so strange and just like slapstick chaos. You know, they weren't, there was rarely a narrative. It was just goofy. And it was almost just playing with stories and making kids' brains melt. I don't know. I loved it.
YouTube needs a defunct land, but for Nickelodeon.
Right.
That needs to happen. I also want to note, especially with No Farther Than the End of the Street, that it's like very tender and sweet too. Which that book seems to sort of be like about domesticity and about you and your partner and just with that layer of fantasticalness thrown on, that I don't feel like I see much, which is not to say that it's not out there, but I personally don't encounter it very much, and it's it was like very nice to read it. I read Cardboard Clouds first. I'm not sure why. I normally read chronologically when people send me books or when I prepare for this podcast. For whatever reason, I read reverse chronologically. But it was kind of cool to go from Cardboard Clouds to No Farther Than the End of the Street. To go into this, to go from this very abstracted, conceptual plays inverse adjacent sort of thing to I love my wife, but there's a whale on the front lawn too.
Yeah, I feel like it's interesting that yeah, reading them in reverse is really fascinating because I feel like the overlap is very high. I think I wrote both of them around the same time. Mm. What I do in my process is often I'll do a free write. I don't know where it's going to go. And then when I look back on it, I'll see like, oh, this one is including a house or a basement or a living room or a front yard. And then as those accumulate, I'm like, oh, maybe this is like a neighborhood poem book thing. And then during COVID, it really helped me kind of look at all these folders and see where the themes were. So because I had all that downtime and I wasn't really writing because the world was so messed up, I was able to actually go through a lot of those first drafts that I would have never otherwise done much with. And that led to me being like, oh, I have 80 circus poems. I have 60 poems that start with on stage and they're these little plays. I have these other ones that take place in someone's home and they deal with a partner or a husband and a wife. And I started to kind of piece all of those together. And from there, when I kind of have those, when I see that through line, I don't think I do that when I do those first drafts, but when I do see that through line, then I kind of get in the conceptual framing. So I think, okay, this is only going to be on one neighborhood street. This whole book is only going to take place in the front yard, in the backyard. If I really want to include something, I have to have it be thematic. So even in that book, there's an airplane poem or an airport poem. And I was like, I want to include this. So let's just have the airport be right in their backyard. Or, okay, this is actually going to be in the basement. Or, oh, I have this weird poem about two guys. Let me make it about a husband and a wife so it can fit in this book. So I kind of like would mold and mesh. And then, yeah, Cardboard Clouds was very similar. I had a lot of, it was almost a generative writing process for me where I would just write on stage, comma, and then I would just try to have two or three characters and no more than like five objects. If I have a blank page, I tend to go way too maximal. And then I have 900 things and 500 characters and it's too much. And then I end up trimming it down to its bare bones. But with this constraint with Cardboard Clouds, I try to start without having to, you know, okay, there's only going to be two characters. I can't have a third or I can't have more than a couple objects. And it led to some really interesting things I think I would have otherwise not written. But yeah, in regards to the tenderness, I was largely inspired and I still am very inspired by Zachary Schomburg. He's a poet and a novelist, and he's been painting a lot these days as well. And his poems are very, it starts out weird and then you're crying by the end because your heart is full. So he definitely does he's a master class in kind of blending that tenderness with the surrealism. And he has a novel called Mammother. It's the only novel that he's written. And that is like such a good book. One of my very favorite novels. And it's basically like one long poem. It's like a fairy tale, a fable. It's just this strange, strange book. And it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. But the whole time you're reading it, you're feeling so much for these characters. It's not just weird for the sake of being weird. You're like bawling by the end, but you're also like, what kind of fever dream am I reading right now? And a lot of his stuff is like that. His poetry is incredible. They're all out with Black Ocean. And then his novel is with Featherproof Books, I think. And he's apparently working on novel two, but I haven't seen any excerpts or anything like that. But yeah, that first book was a big inspiration just for those early poems. Really trying to, yeah, mix the tender with the surrealism. There's another poet, Matthew Olsman. I interviewed him a while ago, and he said for one of his prompts was start with a joke, end with a prayer. And I feel like that kind of mentality has kind of gone through all of my writing, where I don't think I'm necessarily ending with a prayer, but I'm definitely trying to combine that kind of, you know, big-heartedness with kind of a goofy, slapstick, funny humor, you know, laugh to keep from crying type thing.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds so good. Okay, well, I get paid tomorrow, so that's good.
Yeah, Mammother will be right up your alley. You'll
I am looking forward to it. I want to quick go back to what you were saying about assembling these books, because it almost seems like how I imagine writers in a writer's room for a TV show have to do things. And there is an element of serialized television, how I imagine it works, that is very interesting to me in how easy it is to fail, but also how, you know, the constraints informing creativity sort of thing. Like, particularly season two of Twin Peaks, where David Lynch is off doing Mulholland Drive, and you have these writers who are like, oh, what do I have to, what is going on here? And then David coming back to write, you know, the last couple of episodes and having to say, what have they done to this place? And how do I pull it back? You know, I think as writers, especially us who are writing weird things, do tend to look at what we've done 6 months ago and be like, what was this guy thinking? How am I going to do anything with this? And so I really liked that you, I don't know, I guess aren't so precious about like the individual, that you aren't afraid to say, you must be part of this whole, so come along and I will shape you thusly. Because a lot of times it feels like I'm, like things are going in the other direction, where people are trying to, you hear about people say like, I had to figure out what the piece wanted to be. And they're like midwifing this object that is coming from another plane and trying to birth it into the world. I don't know. Why do you think that is for you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think at least when it comes to like those first drafts or approaching the blank page, it's often just like a total stream of consciousness, word vomit. I might throw on some instrumental music and just free write for like, I found that like 14 minutes is my wheelhouse before I get burnt out. And from there, I'll write like 800 words, just kind of going so fast that you're not even really realizing what you're writing. You're ignoring the typos. You're just, you know, vomiting up all the words that you have in your head. And then from there, I'll have, you know, 3, 4, 5 slivers of ideas. And I've just learned over the years that I have just the similar themes or overlaps. So yeah, I often, I do a marketing job now, so I'll be writing something and I'll be like, oh, this is very anti-capitalist, anti-corporation, you know, that kind of thing. That goes in this folder. Oh, this one is anti-authority. This is going in this folder. Mm. Oh, this one's about a circus and magicians and clowns. For whatever reason, I constantly write about that kind of thing. So that goes in this folder. I worked in a library for 9 years, so I had a lot of library poems. So that went in a different folder. I grew up Catholic and I went to a Catholic high school and I questioned my faith every day. So those go in another folder, you know? So as they accumulate at first, you know, those first few 5, 6, 7 pieces that go into the folder, I'm like, this will never be a book. And I even have the Word document just says circus, WTF, no way. Like in my head, I was like, no, there's no way I'm going to get enough for a book. And now that thing is 300 pages and I don't know what it is. But you know, over time they just accumulate. So I do those first kind of word vomit first drafts. And then whenever I have a free Saturday or a Sunday, 1, 2, 3 months down the road, I'll go through all those emails to myself and I'll piece those through. And then I'll kind of do that second draft. And a lot of the times I just, you know, they don't even leave my inbox. It's like, oh, that was fun, but it's not worthy of making it to the Word document. But if I like it enough, then I'll move it to the Word doc, I'll clean it up. And then from there, I'll think, oh, this is going in my, you know, anti-authority book, or this is going in my, I have a book called Goof that's all like pickup jokes or like one-line jokes and like knock-knock jokes. They're terrible. But I'm like, oh, this is a kind of a funny humor one. This is going over here. Or, you know, for Cardboard Clouds, this is more of a stage play. This is going over here. And then from there, yeah, once I have 150, 200, 300 pages of very tiny little pieces, all my stuff is very small, then I'll say, okay, I need to spend like a weekend printing out all the pages, putting them on the ground, taping them to the wall. And then from there, trimming them down to maybe half of that or a third of that even. And then kind of seeing, oh, I have 3 pieces about whales. I had no idea. Let me put these whales next to each other and see how they talk. Or I have 10 clown poems. What the hell? I didn't even know I had one. Let me put those next to each other. Maybe that's a sequence. From there, I can kind of see what all my pieces are, and almost it's almost like chiseling away on a slab of marble or something. But yeah, I kind of categorize by theme, and then from there, when I have enough to work with, then I'm like, okay, I should probably print this out and look at it. And it isn't really until I start printing it out that I think about it as a manuscript or something more than just an idea in a folder.
That's genius. I'm restraining myself from gushing about that hardcore. Again, I feel like we have very different processes. And I'm more of a proser than a poetryist, but the idea of having a system of organization like what you have feels like a light bulb moment for me, because it's there's no organization on my end aside from like pre-made, like Cave Poems doc and Eco Poetics doc, which those two should be similar anyway. And then sort of being like, I guess doing it in reverse again. That's a theme in this episode of saying like, I want to add something to the Eco Poetics doc and sitting down and writing a poem about a deer or whatever. And then coming out. And again, for novels, it's like a completely different thing, because I guess you're kind of thinking about what the thing is ahead of time. Except for the people who, I guess, kind of notice that they have lots of short stories and then combine them together.
Right.
Which is a very sort of like 60s science fiction way of doing things.
So yours is much more, I have the blank page open, I'm going to write toward this manuscript.
Yeah.
Or today I'm going to work on cave poems and write cave poems.
Yeah, it's I want to have a cave poems book. So I have, you know, the Word doc, and I say to myself, I'm on page 20. I'm going to get to page 80 or whatever, because that's about poetry book length. And then we'll go back and, you know, edit around what is there to fill everything out. And you'll notice I have no books of poetry published. So, as a therapist once said to me, how's that going for you?
I would say, if I had to do that and I had to write towards something, I think my brain would just go blank and it would either be a really terrible piece or I just wouldn't even be able to write anything. I think lifting the pressure and lifting the direction, I talked earlier about just being surprised by what I'm writing next. I kind of think about later where it's going to go or what it's going to be. But if I woke up one morning and was like, I'm going to write toward my circus book, I don't think I'd be able to write any good circus poems. But with that word vomit stream of consciousness, if a circus thing pops up, I think it just feels much more exciting for me, because it's shocking, as opposed to today I'm going to write about a juggler and then I'm just going to write like five really bad juggle poems that don't even make it to the next step. But I wish I had that talent to like put the ass in the chair on a Saturday and write towards something. But I'm the opposite, where it's like 60 shitty first drafts, and then maybe 20 of those will lead to four different folders of something that'll be something 2 years down the road.
For sure. And again, I think it comes for me from this desire to be a novelist. The fact that I'm spending more time these days writing poems, I don't know what's going on there, probably because I've been hanging out with poets too much and not novelists. But like, again, from the novelist perspective, it's I have an idea, I have a character, or I have a situation or whatever. Then I expand that out into three acts and write 90,000 words, pare it down to 80, and then boom, Bob's your uncle, there's a novel.
Right.
I think even beyond that for me is I'm a big fan in music of the concept album. So it's, you know, it's not just here's 10 songs. It's here's 10 songs that are telling a story too. And of course you can listen to them individually and it will be fun and fine or whatever. But for those who want to dig deeper, you know, how many Coheed and Cambria fans do you run into who are like, oh man, and there's a comic book series too? Because I was that kid in high school who was like, nah, but no, it's like this shirt isn't a weird band t-shirt. Like, no, these are characters in the science fiction comic book series.
Yeah, we're coming from the same place in that regard. I grew up on, yeah, it was the Flaming Lips, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, and that kind of concept. The Mars Volta, D-Louse in the Comatorium. So good. It was like, oh, this whole thing's written about their friend who has had like a overdose, and he's, you know, they're in his dreams, in his coma. I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, whether they wrote toward that, knowing that concept from the start, or whether they had assemblage of songs and they're like, oh, these are all kind of about that. Probably the former, because if you have that kind of constraint, it works easier. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a big inspiration for some of my stuff and giving myself that restraint is some of those early concept albums, and even as early as Pink Floyd. Yeah, but Flaming Lips, Mars Volta in particular. Yeah, Coheed and Cambria as well.
Yeah. Man, prog rock is so good. Like, yeah, my dad was a big Genesis and Pink Floyd guy in my childhood too. So like, unknowingly, I grew up around The Wall and Lamb Lies Down
the 14-minute songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still think like 7.5 minutes is the perfect length for a song. I think that that's right in the pocket. Right. Yeah. So it's fascinating, you know, to come across someone who works so differently from the way you do. Especially for me, where like, I don't know, I don't talk to a lot of people and I don't talk to a lot of writers. But that's in my personal life, aside from the ones I talk to every day, I don't talk to a large number of them. And the people who I do talk to every day don't write novels. So yeah, I'm just really, it's the point of the episode where I'm just like, yeah, man, writing. And overcome.
I've tried the novel, and I am the opposite. Yeah, I find it so daunting. I am unable to put anything in a certain direction. It's all just like, the closest I've come to a novel has been like a novella in prose poems, or a series of vignettes, or snapshots that write toward a theme. But like the hero's journey and the three-act structure, I think I would struggle so much with that, just because, I mean, I watch so many movies and I read so many like procedural books, and I know that structure. I know how it works. But every time I've tried, I'm just like 100 word paragraph. And I'm like, oh, that was fun. Let me write something completely different next. The idea of, you know, 60,000 to 100,000 words toward one thing, like I envy those good novels. And when I read them, I'm like, I have it in me. I can figure this out. But then I go to the page, I'm like, oh, I don't have it in me. I can't figure this out. It's such an interesting, it's so formulaic, but it just overwhelms the hell out of me.
It's the same thing for me and listening to music versus trying to make music. Like, even listening to like punk songs, it like as soon as I try to break it down on a guitar in my room, I completely lose it. It was like when I was really into StarCraft 2 and I would watch professional StarCraft 2 players play and I'd be like, oh, he made a mistake there. The stalkers need to go, you know, that way and flank them from this way. And then, you know, the second I sit down to play, my fingers are hitting the wrong hotkeys and I completely forget my build order and all that.
Is this the first podcast to connect punk music to StarCraft 2?
I hope so. And if it's not, don't tell me.
Yeah, I love that parallel. That's funny.
Yeah, it has to do with, you know, another thing I've noticed, I've been talking to my wife about this because we watched the newest season of White Lotus. And no spoilers, but there is in every episode a recurring thing that is brought up, and it's small, and it's so based in the characters who are discussing the thing that it feels innocuous, but it's there so much that when it became a big moment at the end, I said, oh, I should have seen that coming. And my wife likes mysteries and true crime and Agatha Christie and stuff like that, where I feel like less so for true crime, where I feel like the point of the engaged audience member is to try to figure out what's going to happen before it happens. And I'm very much a, like, living in the thing as it's happening.
Yeah, I'm just like you in that regard.
And I've started to get self-conscious about that. About, like, am I not engaging with it in... I'm trying not to say, like, in the way that I should, or in the best way, or in the correct way, because there's been enough... I know who listens to the show, and I know the type of work that I'm talking about on this show, that, like, the answer is, like, that's not... You shouldn't ever question that. There is no best way to watch The White Lotus or whatever. But on the other hand, I think it... While I agree with that, I do think it is worth every now and again kind of reevaluating the way that you consume things. Mm-hmm. In innocuous ways, like, oh, should I have seen by episode 4 that this was going to be a thing in White Lotus? Or in more important ways, like, should I really be spending 6 hours a week watching leftist video essays? Is that the best use of my time?
Yeah, like, am I picking up on those curiosity seeds, or am I not even noticing? Yeah, I had the same thing. And another one that comes to mind is that movie, The Babadook, which everyone said was so scary when it came out. I watched it. I liked it. And I remember talking to somebody and being like, oh, that was a good, it was an interesting movie. I hadn't really seen Australian horror before. And someone was like, oh, The Babadook is totally a metaphor for her, like, mental illness and depression and her grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I didn't pick up on that at all. I just thought it was a good movie. You know, I'm not... So rarely am I looking deeper, you know, I'm not thinking about, oh, what does this really mean? What's this? Is this a hidden message for something else? I just usually think, oh, that was a cool movie. I'm rarely thinking like, oh, the glass of water stands for, you know, grief or depression, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. So very often I'm like, oh, there were some really cool scenes. I like the cinematography. The story surprised me and I was entertained. But yeah, rarely am I like ready to do a deep dive, you know, long form Substack essay on the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Especially now that I'm a dad, I have so little time to watch movies that watching movies more than once feels like, I don't know, incorrect or not a waste. But, like, I can tell you on one streaming service right now, there's probably 5 movies that every time I see the thumbnail, I'm like, oh, I need to see that. And back when I was watching lots of movies, back when I was watching 200 movies a year, I wasn't rewatching movies because I was, like, trying to see all of the movies.
Right.
But I do find that when I do rewatch movies, it is easier to... whatever. Or when I see a movie knowing, like, The Substance, I was kind of like, I went into that ready to do a feminist critical analysis of The Substance, and came away, I think, non sequitur, with very different conclusions than everybody else, because that seemed much more like a movie about substance abuse and addiction than it did about, like, society not valuing middle-aged women enough. But I also told myself I wasn't going to watch or read anybody else's analysis of The Substance. So I won't burden it with anybody with mine. It's a fun body horror movie. You should see it.
Right. There's no hidden meaning at all.
Demi Moore is great. And let's ignore the fact that she's doing Royal Match, commercials on, right. on my Words with Friends ads. Let's ignore that entirely.
Yeah, the same thing with some of my writing. I'll read something or I'll share something with my wife, and she's not a poet or a writer, and she'll say, what does that mean? Or what was this even about? You know, I have one piece where someone's opening a safe and there's a turkey inside, and then they open the turkey and there's a safe inside, and they open the safe and there's a turkey, and kind of just going down this rabbit hole. She's like, what does it mean? And I'm like, I have no idea. I don't know. You know, I'm rarely writing stuff and thinking, oh, the turkey is a metaphor for whatever, you know, the safe is a metaphor for locked up aggression. You know, it's nothing like that. I'm just kind of, like I said earlier, I'm just trying to surprise and shock myself, but so rarely do I even know what my own stuff is about. And if it's open to interpretation, I think it's all the better, because I'm never, rarely am I trying to say like, and that's the way it was, they lived happily ever after. Usually it's like some open-ended weird visual, or I'll say, and over to the left, a kid is, you know, hitting a tree with a stick, and you're like, what the hell is even going on? If anything, I'm trying to bewilder or flabbergast people as opposed to telling them the metaphor or the hidden meaning. Because yeah, I rarely even know myself.
Yeah, absolutely. I like something I said once on the show that somebody else responded to, so it's one of the only things I remember saying, is I like it when other people read my work so I know what's going on with it.
I love that. That's too true, right?
Yeah, and it's great that that is what some of my stuff is for me. And again, I'm pleased that that's what your writing is too, because I have a fear of being really stupid in general, but particularly on this show, where there are some questions I will have but refuse to ask out of fear that the answer is probably really obvious. And it's just like, oh, you didn't read that my book very closely then, did you? Or worse, oh, did I not make that clear enough? I really wanted to make that really clear. So right, you'll notice
the author second guess everything.
Yeah, so you'll notice I don't ask a whole lot of like, yeah, what is why businessmen in cardboard clouds? Why businessmen? You know, because it feels like, you know, that is either, again, it feels like the answer is either, oh, geez, did I not make that clear? Or, oh, you said you read and liked the book, but you don't know the first thing about
right,
it.
Right, right. Yeah, whereas the answer to that question is, I don't really know. I think I was trying to make the most, like, general masculine character. But I honestly have no idea why I even had that character be businessman. Yeah. Yeah, and so often I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. Just trying to entertain myself without thinking too deeply on it.
Cool. Okay, we're going to transition now. I think that that's a great place to...
That's perfect.
It's a good place to stop. You have started a press.
Yes.
And again, as I said off the air, I'm Polish, but not that Polish. Would you say the name of your press?
Yeah, it's Pijama Press, and which is pajamas in Polish. And my last name is Nespajani. And growing up in northern Indiana, middle of nowhere, I had, you know, everyone, and I guess everyone I come across with, largely even in Chicago, have trouble pronouncing my name. And one of my friend's dads in middle school had no idea how to pronounce my name. So he just started calling me Nyan Pajamas because he thought that's close enough. And he started even using it as like a curse word when he was playing golf. Apparently I heard that, like,
that's fantastic.
He would like miss a putt and be like, Nyan Pajamas. So that was like my first AOL username. That was my first like MySpace handle. I mean, it's been my like moniker online ever since. I always thought that was so cool. And it was just easier to say than Nespajani, which no one knows how to pronounce. So kind of riffing off of the pajamas and Nyan Pajamas, I was just trying to see, like, I was trying to find, at first I was like, oh, I'll just call the press Nyan Pajamas. But then I was like, no, I want to have something different. I want to have it be its own unique thing. And I was just looking on Google Translate, and I was like, I wonder what pajamas is in Polish. And it was just pijama. And I was like, that's so nice, you know, and it can be, yeah, pajama. People have also said, like, Pajama Press, and someone I ran into at a bar in Chicago, oh, you run that Pajama Press. I'm like, that's awesome. Like, if you pronounce it like pajamas, that's awesome. So it's really just kind of like a sub umbrella, I guess, of the Nyan Pajamas cinematic universe, for lack of a better phrase.
Cool. So what, I want to say this with like four different tones at the same time. Why start a press?
That's a good question. And it was probably 2020. I was going on all these daily walks, trying not to lose my mind during quarantine. And I started learning about podcasts and listening to literary chats. And I really like this writer, Joanna Rocco. She has a bunch of books out with like small presses like Tarpaulin Sky and Dorothy Project. And she's also a romance novelist under Joanna Lowell. I haven't read any of those yet, but she has like 5 books under the romance moniker. But hyper prolific. She teaches at Wake Forest. I think she's just like the coolest writer. And I just searched her name in Spotify one day just to see like, is there any interview with Joanna? I just need some like some literary juice for my walk. And there was a FC2 conversation with her and this novelist, debut novelist, Kikaraki Kawaguchi. And I didn't know who he was. And I just listened to it. And it's such a nice like fireside chat conversation. They're going back and forth, little Zoom talk. And someone reads his short story at the very beginning. And then they just spend the next like 45 minutes talking about it. And afterwards, I was like, I loved that little excerpt. I loved what they were saying. Like, obviously, he has a co-sign for one of my favorite writers. Let me just see what he's written. So I grabbed his book and I just fell in love with it. It's a debut novel, but it's told in these like 1 to 2 page vignettes. It's called The Book of Cain and Margaret. And it's about his grandparents in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. And every single chapter, they kind of reinvent themselves. In one chapter, they're bugs. In one chapter, they're in their hundreds. In another chapter, they're in their teens. In another chapter, they're like, they can fly over the barbed wire fences. And each chapter, they fall in love again, or they die, or they get brought back to life. And then each new chapter, it's kind of like South Park or Family Guy. Like, if they died in the last episode, they're going to come back. And it's very surreal. Like we talked earlier, like, you'll be crying while you're reading it, but it's also so surreal and so magical. A really beautiful book. So me being the kind of curious literary advocate, I guess, or literary citizen, I emailed him and I was like, I love your book. I'd love to interview you. What else are you working on? You know, just trying to pick his brain and get started with the conversation. And he told me that he had this book of poems, this manuscript that got accepted with 1913 Press, and it was coming out soon. So I sent him a bunch of interview questions, and then I didn't hear back from him for a while, but he had sent me the PDF and I read it and I was like, oh my God, this is so good. This is incredible. Like, laugh out loud, funny poems, weird, strange, grotesque, sexual poems. And I didn't hear back from him, and I read it again and I followed up. And then about a year went by, 2021 or 2022. And I said, hey, you know, when's that book coming out? I'll be the first person to pre-order. Like, I can't wait for that book to come out. And he said, oh, the press shuttered during COVID. They're done. I've kind of given up on the manuscript. I tried to shop it around, but I've just kind of cut my losses and it's done. And I was just devastated. And another year went by, or maybe even 2 years. And I had read it another 2-3 times. It kind of became my comfort read. And I was on another long walk listening to the Other People podcast. And he's been doing these like craft talk series. And one was with Chelsea Hodson talking about starting your own literary press or launching your indie press or whatever it was called. And I stopped in my tracks on my walk and I emailed Keek and I said, hey, if that book is still available, you know, I'm listening to this podcast. I'm super motivated right now. I would love to launch a press and have your book be my first book. I think it needs eyes. I feel terrible that it hasn't been released yet. And I want my first book as a press to be your book. And he responded like a couple hours later, like, yes, oh my gosh, yes, totally. Let's go. So it was much less of like, let me launch a press. Who wants to be part of it? And much more like, this book needs to be in the world. How can I help? And part of me was like, oh, maybe I'll be his publicist or an agent, try to get it sold. And that just sounded too corporate, schemey. And then, yeah, that podcast episode really inspired me just to like take that leap. And it was last summer, so June or July, that I emailed him. And then I announced it January 1st of this year. And I'm trying just to do 1 or 2 books a year to not overwhelm myself, and always releasing in May, taking a page out of the Dorothy Project's release schedule. They do 2 books a year, always together, always on the same day. So I'm really trying to do that and not get overwhelmed and not be defunct in 3 years. But the first year, just 1 book. And then next year, hopefully 2. The year after that, hopefully 2. And then we'll just see how long I can sustain it. But yeah, I wanted to see if I could do it. And I didn't know what I didn't know. And I've learned such a wild amount of stuff about the whole industry in the last 8-9 months. From InDesign files to buying an ISBN to trying to pitch my stuff to Asterism for distro. All this stuff is brand new, but it's really exciting.
You know, that's so funny. A lot of the people I know who have started indie presses did so for similar reasons, but without the benefit of it being another person where it's like, yeah, you know, I wrote a couple books and I couldn't get them published anywhere. And I was finding people who were writing like me. And I said, oh, okay, I'll make a press. And you just skip the part where it's about you. Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, I think, I just really wanted that book to be out there. And I mean, I always I do Q&A via email interviews on my website. Mm-hmm. And if I really like a book or I really like an author, I try to pick their brain and find out how they tick. So I've always kind of had that connection. And you know, I do bi-monthly reading series in Chicago where I invite readers to read for 15, 20 minutes. So I've always kind of had that like community collaborative, you know, whatever that is inside of me, where I'm not just kind of on my island writing by myself. So I'm almost always trying to like bring in other people. So if I can help uplift somebody else, that makes me more excited than having my own stuff out there in the world. And Keek's book just felt like something that needed to be out there. And when I found out that he gave up, I was like, what the hell? Like, this thing needs to be in the world. It is the funniest thing I've read. It's the weirdest thing I've read. Let's see what we can do. But yeah, I'm glad that that was the first one, because yeah, I think if I would have tried it the other way, I maybe either wouldn't have been as happy with the first book in the press, but I think starting with one that you feel so passionate about is just the really, really the best way to launch something into the world.
I agree. The book's called Disintegration Made Plain and Easy. And I guess going with the theme of reading the stuff sort of reverse chronological, I read that before I read yours.
Nice.
And it's fascinating how your writing and his writing like come from or cut from a similar cloth in terms of like, I don't know, same school of vibe, I guess. I really like how his poems are all, not all, but largely one-line stanzas. It feels... I was just at a poetry open mic earlier this afternoon.
Nice.
And I caught a glimpse of some of the older ladies who were there, who had like their printed out laminated poem that were kind of formatted like that too. And an older guy too. So maybe it was just ease of reading. But it struck me as that sort of, I don't know, an earnestness, you know, the earnestness of a middle-aged woman at a poetry reading at a leftist bookstore. Where she's just like, I really want to read my moon poem to these kids. I'm 32. I'm not a kid. Ugh. But you know what I mean, right? Like,
yeah. I love that comparison too. Yeah. He had said when I talked to him that the initial idea was, I guess there's this old antiquated book called The Art of Cookery Made Plain and Easy, talking about how, you know, cooking isn't that difficult. You can do it too. So he wanted the book to really look like this ornate, vintage, old, weird cookbook. And then you open it up and it's all like weird, grotesque, getting naked poems, you know? Mm. So like very off-putting. I've kind of pitched it a couple times as like R-rated Shel Silverstein or something like that. But on the surface, like you said, it looks very traditional and just like traditional poetry. But then you bring in the illustrations, you bring in the actual content in the books, and it's just the weirdest stuff you've ever read. But on the surface, it looks very, yeah. I thought the cover reminds me of a book, like the Book of the Dead, like Indiana Jones might find this book. But he really wanted to be, yeah, like an 1800 cookbook for like how to teach your wife how to get in line, like some old school stuff like that. But then you read this book and it's just about like deep vulnerability and uncertainty and Nicki Minaj lyrics, just like the weirdest stuff you've read.
The Nicki Minaj poem is a great poem to sell the book with.
Right.
I think it's super funny. I also like the recurring about the author sections.
Oh, I love that too.
That happen. It reminded me of, and I'm going to get the name of this book wrong too, but Mike Klein and Dan Hoy wrote a book together a couple of years ago with a super long title. And they
had, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah. And the I don't know, title page is kind of in the middle or near the end of the first third.
Right, right.
Because they said that they like how in 80s movies, the title screen doesn't show up sometimes until like half an hour into the movie. And so when I first came across the first about the author on page like 25 or whatever, it reminded me of that, which is interesting because I guess his writing does also feel similar to Mike's in that way. And I guess yours too, where it's that sort of like unafraidness, lack of fear to kind of just put something strange in and see right. what happens. Mike's work has been getting darker and darker. But in general, that sort of like, I'm going to have Godzilla show up. A very like children playing sort of
right
thing.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, like that, like we talked about earlier, like the Ren and Stimpy, like kind of cartoonish, but also twisted and dark, and you're not sure if it'll give you nightmares or if you should be laughing. And yeah, I think Keek stuff is like that too, where it has that tenderness. It often ends, almost all the poems end very poetic, and you're almost like surprised.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, this is such a good bit. This is hysterical. Oh my God, I'm devastated. You know, he kind of takes those turns. I certainly try and do that, but I feel like he... maybe gives himself even less rules. I don't think I necessarily give myself rules, but I think with my writing, I often find an image and I kind of stick to the bit. And I feel like his pieces, he really, it's like a long winding ramble and you don't know where it's going to go. And I've tried to write like that, but I have a lot of trouble as like that kind of stream of consciousness, but he'll throw in 60 ideas into a 2-page poem. Whereas mine's like, oh, I got this cool visual. I'm going to have it be 100-word prose poem all about this one visual.
Mm.
Maybe starting at the same place, but ending in very different locations. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mentioned earlier the painter Vladimir Kush, who does those surrealist paintings where things are kind of melting into each other. One of my favorite paintings of his is it's like the body of an elephant and its head morphs into a tuba.
Nice.
And
is he the one where it's like an egg cracking and it's the sunset or something like that? It's like a big egg.
Oh, maybe.
And I think the sun is like the egg over easy. Yeah, I think that might be him. Might be Salvador Dali, but I'm thinking that
Dali did a lot of eggs, but I did just look him up. Yeah, and it's one of the first ones. Yeah, he's got like the bananas on the hammock.
Oh, nice.
Where it's like a banana peel rocking a hammock that is also a banana peel, and inside of the hammock is like the berry, the flesh of the banana with a human face.
That could pretty much be the first two sentences for one of my prose poems. I feel like I could riff off of that for days.
Oh, dude, do Vladimir Kush Ekphraxis poems.
Yes.
That would be so sick.
Banana hammock.
Yeah. You know, hey, guys, if you like AI-generated art, may I introduce you to Vladimir Kush and Beksinski, because the jank of AI-generated images that can be charming is, like, their whole thing. The second wave of surrealist painters. It's like their whole thing is that jank. I dread the day, again, non sequitur, I dread the day that Beksinski's work is like being dinged off of whatever comes off after Instagram because whatever AI they use to take down AI generated imagery because it's against right. the rules just immediately sees it and is like, nope, get that out of here. that image has too many fingers, go away. And speaking of art, I like the drawings that accompany the poems in this book. And Disintegration.
Yeah, I think they're really special. They, the first book that I mentioned earlier, The Book of Cain and Margaret, his debut novel, also had illustrations from, his name is Gao, I'm going to mess up his full name, Gautam Rangan. And they were college, like best friends in undergrad. And they've just been kind of collaborating here and there over the years. So he got him to work on a couple of illustrations for his first book. And then with this one, he commissioned him just for a couple illustrations. And because the book was on hiatus for so long, he just kept drawing toward this book because it took so long. So it's actually a blessing in disguise, because by the time the book actually came out, there was illustration for every single page. Whereas the 2022 version or the 2021 version, I think there was 6 or 7 illustrations total. So it really gave him the option or the opportunity to kind of just keep going, you know, going above and beyond his commission, friend collaboration, and really resonating with it. But this same artist has done like 6-story tall installations in the Singapore airport, like light fractal images. He's done like stuff where lights will respond to your hand motions inside of art galleries. He's done a lot of like almost like Jackson Pollock, just like throwing stuff at a paint canvas. If you go on his website, he's incredibly eclectic. He does very multiple styles. And it seems like these line art was almost like a way for him to almost like, maybe not a palate cleanser, but almost like a way for him to be like, I'm focusing on this 7-foot tall thing and I need a little break. So I'm going to draw this little weird butterfly and then I'll go back to my project. It was almost like, it probably just was almost like a way for him to kind of just relax and not even think about it. Cause I feel like they come so naturally to him. He's just a naturally talented illustrator. And he generated about 100 of them because of the book.
Yeah. I Googled him and I was on the homepage of his website and I was like, is this the same guy?
Yeah. Super prolific. Like he's been covered with National Geographic and he's done huge installations in various locations. He lives in LA and he really helped bring this project to the final finish line, because I was kind of in over my head with the InDesign file. I didn't know what I was doing. And he was really doing a great job of, oh, this is a bleed. This is going to bleed through. We have to make sure this is good. This text is going to be in the gutter. You want to avoid that. And we would do these Zoom calls where he would share his screen. And it was like a masterclass in how to do Adobe. And he's just such a smart, artistically driven guy. So he really helped take this to the next level. I wouldn't have been able to do that without him.
Yeah. Good for him. Holy cow. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a legend. And he's like the friendliest guy too. So nice.
Fantastic. I think that this is a really good book to start the press with. And I guess maybe this is kind of like wrapping up everything. But you know, the website, your website, the page for the press says, Pyjama Press is an independent press dedicated to showcasing and uplifting the voices of the strange, the uncanny, the absurd, and the surreal. The weirder, the better. And I like that Disintegration Made Plain and Easy is the pace car for what's to come next. Because again, my knee jerk for when I hear about the strange, the uncanny, the absurd, the surreal, the weirder, the better is like blood and guts and people's limbs falling off and tentacle monsters from beyond this plane of existence that looking upon would break your mind and that sort of thing. And I really appreciate the not necessarily reclaiming, but the assertion that like, no, these things are within those terms too. And I don't get the, I don't get the feeling that that's what you're trying to do or say is like provide a counterpoint to the horrification of absurd and weird and surreal. But for me, the guy who's wearing a cramped shirt with a human fly on it right now as we record, it's nice to be reminded and to have somebody give me the permission even to be like, no, weird and absurd and surreal can also mean silly and and fun, and not every dream is a nightmare, that sort of thing. So yeah. Like...
It can be a weird dream and not keep you up at night.
Yeah. So I appreciate it just in that way. Just kind of a general appreciation for the vibe, man.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, and I don't think, you know, I definitely won't limit it to the style. I think moving forward, like I said, 1 to 2 books a year. But if a really weird, strange horror book comes into my inbox, maybe that's the next one, you know. I think the only kind of constraint that I'm having is I love a book under 200 pages. So I think that might be, at least like the first 10 will probably be just like slim. But whether that's a novella or a book of poems or a book of flash fiction or whatever they may be, splatterpunk, whatever, I think as long as it's weird, I think that's kind of my only rubric. Weird and good, and ideally, yeah, novella length or shorter. So I will start by reading, we mentioned earlier, the About the Author series in Keek's book. He has a series of fake bios where he's kind of just making up things about himself. And there's 6 of them in the book. And he said that he wrote about 20 of them that also didn't even make the cut. Some of them originally appeared in Electric Literature. So I will start by reading one of them. And then I ripped off of that, wrote my own bio that was published in HAD. So I'll read that as well. And I like to start out my like in-person readings and stuff reading that one because it's almost like a strange palate cleanser of who I am not, but also to give you an idea of who I am. So I'll start with Keek's About the Author. Keek Araki Kawaguchi's first book of poems made no impact whatsoever. Critics were not pleased by it, saying, "We have no knowledge or record of her whatsoever." Keek usually is a man, unless no record exists, in which case he is a woman. She was winner of the Hemophiliacs Hospital Raffle. Keek lives here in this room. When you switch off the lights, he comes in through the window and eats out of the garbage. Because he's eaten the garbage 7 years, it is molecularly accurate if you say Keek is mostly water garbage. When the lights come on, Keek deflates and he crawls inside this tiny box. A pupa wraps its mitten of fur around the word. The mouth of flower rubs its ghost over the flute. The angel of steam raises its palm flush to the barrel. I love that poem so much. So I will read my poor imitation of this, kind of riffing off of just my own fake About the Author. And this was published in HAD last month. About the Author, for Keek Araki Kawaguchi. Benjamin Nespajani's body of work is a lobby of dirt, a hallway for cloud gazing, a raisin telling the sand it's a plum. His hum has been classified as a statement on sauce. His saliva has been published in Skunk Tongue Review, Tulip Spit, and less than a few others. He's won nothing and never will. If you kill him, the wind won't notice, and neither will his therapist, Terrence the Ghost. The recipient of the 2022 shoe shine, Nespajani splits his time between eating seasons and sleeping alone. If you know him well enough to pronounce his name correctly, no one will believe you, not even him. His kids don't exist. His piss, it glows. And then I will read 2 other ones from Keek's book just to give you a better idea of this weird debut collection. And I'll close with those. And like we said earlier, they are largely just one long stanza, no punctuation, no periods, just kind of one rambling thought. So I'll try to read this how he would like it to be read. This one's called Sleep Story. Men have 2 fears. The first is crashing your hang glider into the center of the ocean at 1 a.m. and having to swim around naked for hours until a shark hears you splashing. The other fear is living forever, after everyone is dead, especially after our sun implodes and every day you are just waving your arms and drifting by Mars in eye bulgy agony, like Arnold Schwarzenegger in that unforgettable movie, Kindergarten Cop. Seeing this aloud, I suppose these fears are exactly the same, which makes sense because men so rarely have differences, afraid of being lonely and also the dark. Even the dark is just a physical representation of a man's loneliness. It spills out of him, the black dew of a melon hacked at its waist. I do not know why I must hang glide nakedly. I suppose because the more naked you are, the closer you can get to the sun. That was my first time reading that one out loud, and I love it so much. I also love how you're supposed to think Total Recall by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he says Kindergarten Cop. And then I will close with his poem, I Have Run Naked, Thrashing, and Flailing. Another one long stanza poem. I have run naked, thrashing and flailing, through a storm of yellow jackets. What lay after the storm was called death, and what came before the storm was called death. Upon the face of every yellow jacket was sugar enough all smiled while we tried to kill each other, and upon the ass of every yellow jacket was enough poison to stun and drown a pod of whales. I have run naked, singing through an incendiary golden vapor, the music before me, after me, suspended in death. The air belongs to them, those animals, pinging in my throat. They belong to the song, and the song belongs to time. ¶¶